been at Washington State University for 3 years. I'm there as a professor and as dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine. Before that, I was at the University of California, where I was head beagle for 1,200 beagles, and I had the biggest cat house in Northern California. I was also a professor in the medical school, in the veterinary school, and in the graduate school in environmental sciences. And before that, I was at Hanford Laboratories, the General Electric Company, for 15 years. I spent most of my scientific career looking at the effects of energy effluents on the biota, chiefly in animals, for extrapolation of the results to people, emphasizing initially the nuclear aspects. And this is one of my chief interests, I guess. I have spent much of my life observing animals and they me, and on the last count they're ahead. So that's sort of it. And among these things, my education was in agriculture and education at the master's level in animal nutrition, and then a degree in veterinary medicine, a professional degree. And then my PhD is from the University of Washington School of Medicine in Physiology and Biophysics. And then I had some special work in nuclear engineering and some work also at Harvard Teaching Hospital in certain areas. So I've had an interesting life. It took me a long time to get out of school because I was a slow learner. The thing that we're addressing today has to do with food, which is so important for so many reasons. And I'm addressing it from the standpoint that I have had a bit of work, probably not as much as many of you here, in the area of nutrition and the research end of things. I have followed it with some interest, and I have also served on the Food Protection Committee of the National Academy of Sciences, which is a body that looks at additives to foods. They're the ones that recommend, for example, look at the final data, whether you could have like cyclamates and saccharin. What about this? And what about red 3? And what about all these other things? I was not on the committee when they made the decision on cyclamates. I was opposed to doing away with cyclamates. I managed to have some, so I just ran out of cyclamates just recently. I'm sorry I didn't make any more. But we'll get into that a little bit. The person that knows more about this than I is the girl at my left, and that's Dorothy Halverson. She's a nutritionist, and she's going to have something to say, and she's going to correct my pet peeves here. But I thought it'd be appropriate to start out with an examination. This is a true and false test, and I think it's a good place to start. And I'm not going to. I don't think I'll ask any of you how you voted on this, whether you said true or false. But then you can challenge me for my answers, and Dorothy may challenge me too. Are there anyone here who runs their own a health food store? Anybody? Okay.
I sell a food supplement.
Okay.
Which is from a store, but it's individual.
Yeah. All right. Your first test question is, and you have to think now whether you mark true or false. And you don't have to tell me. Chemicals added to foods are poisoning us. Chemicals added to foods are poisoning us. Number two, enriched white bread is about as nutritious as sawdust. I've heard that 132 times. Enriched white bread is about as nutritious as sawdust. Number three, you should eat only raw fruits and vegetables. In other words, if you eat fruits and vegetables, which you should eat, eat them raw. Only rock. Yeah. And the fourth one is raw milk is better for you than pasteurized milk. And five, raw sugar and honey are more nutritious than white sugar. That's your five questions for today. And in my authorities say, if you marked any of them true, you flunked. Because my answer to all of them are false. And I will explain the reasons for my answers. And Dorothy will correct them. Maybe she can make some of them true. This whole chemical bit, you have to realize that, you know, chemicals is the name of the game. Everything we eat is eventually, most of us, reduced down to chemicals, and that's how our body uses them. My attitude on chemicals is that some are good and some aren't good. Some are toxic in fairly low levels. And I don't know any of them that aren't toxic if you take enough of them. Maybe you can name something, but I can't think of anything, including salt. You can really overdo that. So I think that's in part a myth. Now, that isn't to say that some of the chemicals that we take, that we're exposed to, are not hurting us. I don't say that, because there's an indication. And part of my life was spent as a director of a cancer laboratory, University of California. Although we were dealing mainly in viral oncology, that is, virus causation in tumors, we were also interested, and more so now at Washington State University, we're trying to put things together for cancer, looking at the chemicals. And there are some people who are in a position to know a good deal about this, feel that the cancers that we have, one of the principal agents involved, which is many times a complex etiology, but one of the great contributors to this, and probably 80% of the cancers, are chemicals in our environment, in our from gaseous effluents from certain plants and from automobiles and burning coal and gas and stuff like that. But these chemical additives, in fact, are the chemicals that we've recommended being added, at least on the Food Protection Committee. I no longer serve on it, because you serve for a certain time and then they bring in somebody else, so you can get more and more input onto it from a greater diversity of people. About the chemical additives that have been approved of, we don't approve of them, we give information regarding them. Have helped you rather than hurt you, as far as I can tell. On the enriched white bread is about as nutritious as sawdust. White bread is in most places that I know of, they have to have additives to them to make up for some of the materials taken out when you don't have the wheat germ and the other things. They have, I think most of them have thiamine, riboflavin added. Many of them have powdered milk. They have iron added. And much of whether it's white or brown bread is a carbohydrate, and we need some of that. So white bread is nutritious, the one that you have. Now, that is not to say that whole wheat, if that's your bag, eat it. And it is good for you. For some of us, we can't take it. But if you can, it's very important to you from the standpoint of fiber. Yes, fiber is a very important component of the diet. Fairly recently discovered. A lot of us knew it for a long time. But these things sort of get, they come and go. I suppose your grandmother knew it was good. My grandmother probably knew it was good. In fact, she tried to feed me flatbread before I had teeth. But fiber is very important to us. And part of the observation for this, and I think I mentioned this before, There's a fellow I know named Burkitt, who was one of the great proponents of this. Burkitt is he's sort of Gideon-like fellow. That'd be interesting to you. He's really a great guy. He's a friend of Tournier's. He's a physician from England, but he spent a lot of his time in Africa. And he does a lot of what we call epidemiology. He looks at populations of people and looks over what are their incidents of disease. And he was the one that discovered and described Burkitt's lymphoma. You've seen children, black children, in certain parts of Africa, where they're way out like this, and their eyes are displaced, and it's a terrible disease. Now we can chemically treat it. And a fellow named Epstein and Barr, two different people, I don't know Barr, I know Epstein, they discovered the virus, they think, that causes this. But Burkitt was the one that described this originally. And now, it's the same virus that causes mononucleosis in this country. And that's this differently. It's probably related in that country to a vector, and they respond to it in this way. But it's with chemical treatment now, and it's fairly good, fairly well in control. But there's a big debate going on, and I'm sort of going off the subject here. And I've heard part of the debate with Sabin and with Epstein and some of these people. And Klein at the Karolinska in Stockholm, they're wondering should they try a vaccine for it. One of the things, of course, that's of interest to some people in the cancer field is, can we develop a vaccine for certain cancers? We have been successful in the animal end of things in this regard in one special area, in a DNA virus called Merrick's disease. It's a disease that really ravages poultry, and we'd be in terrible shape today if we didn't have a vaccine for it. And some veterinarians and others developed a vaccine for this. They modified the virus in a turkey, as I recall, and it has been effective. And it was on the basis of that, partially, that they thought maybe it could be successful with another DNA virus, which the EB virus is. But since they are controlling fairly well chemicals, the problem won't go this route. We also looked at it when I was in California. We were looking, and in fact, in a sarcoma in a cat, we were the first ones to describe this virus in the cat, my associates, and we developed some antisera and also grew the virus, and then infected some cats, and then with the protective sera also introduced, we showed that we could protect cats against this by our system of utilization. Some veterinarians at Glasgow are developing, I think, a vaccine in for leukemia in cats. So there are some interesting things, but I'm going off the subject. I'm going to bring you back to nutrition now. Because Burkitt also, in his epidemiological studies in Africa, says, you know, why are the people here not suffering from heart disease, and they don't have gallbladder trouble, and they don't have like I have diverticulosis, and a lot of GI. Or colon cancer. Why is that? And he's also he's a great fellow. He has a remarkable description he does with slides and everything of stool specimens. He says, "Boy, look at that great stool there, you know, and this puny one here. See, well, that's part of our problem, you know. In the old days when we had a problem with our GI tract, put you on a soft diet, baby food and stuff like that. Well, that probably wasn't the best way to go. I used to say there ain't no flies on me, but there are today. And he said that it's the bulk in the diet. And so now, because of his work and other people, they said, boy, gotta have bulk in your diet. So that's Burkitt. Now, how did I get off on that? Oh, yeah, that's why you might want to have whole wheat bread and some of that. Now, rye bread, Rye bread, for some people, that's bad news. For me, I love rye bread, but boy, it raises havoc with me. And our daughter Karen was having trouble. She likes to bake bread, and she's a very good bread maker. And she was having some GI upset. And well, it's usually nerves. You always say, well, you got nerves, you know. But I told her she got nerves, but she's also eating too much rye bread. And of course, when the father tells a daughter or a son this, chances are they won't believe it. But when all else fails, she tried it. And she found out she can't take rye flour either. Some people are that way. And that's one of the mistakes we make in medicine and in prescribing nutrition and prescribing a lot of things. We always do it by the average. You weigh so much and you're this high or something, and so you should take this dose of such and such. That's a bunch of malarkey. Because our body chemistry varies, age makes a lot of difference, and probably how you handle certain things differs whether you're sick or well. So you have all these variables, and the good diagnostician, the good physician, is the one that can see and understand these differences and recognize them. You know, we handle people this way, sort of average, don't we? Yet as I look over you, and as you look at me, you know, never seen one like that before, see? Well, you're all different. Different heights, different weights, and everything. Chances are your body chemistry is also different, see? How you handle these things. So you be aware of that. But you should take roughage if you can handle it. For me, I have to really watch it. I can't eat a whole apple. Huh? I love apples. Eat one a day keeps the doctor away. Well, it brings them to me. Well, they usually don't come. I go and see them. Usually wait, too. Number three, you should eat only raw fruits and vegetables. Now that's a bunch of malarkey. Some of them are good, raw, but there are many of them that are better for you if they're boiled. Breaks down the walls, a lot of it's cellulose. They're more digestible because cooking breaks some of it down. I think this is true with carrots, cauliflower, spinach, and some other broccoli. Yeah. Now, say, I am sup. You should have your say here, Dorothy. How about number one? What do you want to say about chemicals? I get carried away here.
Well, I was just thinking. See, when I came up here, I didn't take any books. And Leo told me I was going to help him do this. So I went over to the library. There's nothing in the library either. Nutrition.
Well, I bet there's going to be now this next year.
But anyway, I was thinking, I did teach home economics in Minnesota. And I was thinking that really the chemistry department in the high schools and the home economics food department should work more closely together, because then I think we'd be able to educate our people more about chemicals, because after all food is made up of hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, sulfur. Isn't that the basis for all food? You see, there are chemicals in everything. You just can't get away from it. And I was thinking we must start teaching our people about this, probably at a lower level. We have to toot our horns a little bit louder in home economics and teach our young people just what these chemicals are, because it would also be much more valuable as far as labeling is concerned. I think our people don't know what they are reading as far as labels in food.
What about white bread? I know that that Al makes bread for you every Saturday out of whole ground whole wheat flour from up at up north of Piazza Pullman. You want to have a testimonial for whole wheat versus white bread?
He makes very good bread. Now, he makes a bread out of unifying flour, which was developed at Washington State University. And this flour, they take the whole berries and grind it completely, very fine. And during the grinding process, there is some heat generated so that this flour does not become rancid easily. And therefore, they can use the whole berry so there's nothing taken out or nothing put in. And this flour is available only in certain parts of Washington. And I don't know if there are any other flour companies that are picking this up. We tried some Stone Burr whole wheat flour, and this was not ground nearly as fine.
By the way, the bread I make, Leo, is half white flour and half whole wheat.
Yeah. But white flour is fully as nutritious as whole wheat flour.
Thank you for that. I'm going to get to you, Keith. I just want to... You should tell them where you get this flour in case somebody wants to get it there. It's up at...
There's a mill up at Fairfield, Washington. A local farmer out there. I don't know the exact details, but at least he bought a mill that will process the wheat this way to produce a flour. It's a whole wheat flour. His trade name for it is Unifine. Unifine. U-N-I-F-I-N-E. We can get it in Pullman in our local grocery store. Many of the health food stores carry it. That might be your most likely place for finding it. There is another mill at Oakdale, by the way, that makes it, but I think he sells it to only on a wholesale basis, and I don't know the trade name in for it. There may be other places around the country that do the same thing, but it's developed, the milling process is different, and maybe the milling process is also called the Unifine process, I'm not sure, but at least the flour trade name is Unifine.
Did Washington State patent it?
I don't think they patented it, I'm not sure about that.
Keith, you had a question.
Yes, you mentioned that the white bread has certain things added.
Yes.
And I've heard, and I'd like a comment on it, to know that when things are added to it, that they aren't, that it's not as good as if it was there in the first place, or that it was never taken out.
Yeah, I don't believe that, no. And Dorothy doesn't either.
Yeah, so then taking vitamin pills is a good way to get vitamins anyway?
Yeah, they're all chemicals. There's a big... A lot of people get really shook up about saying, boy, the natural vitamins are better than the regular vitamins. And the truth of the matter is, I think if you find out that, if you check into it, that a lot of the so-called natural vitamins have a little bit of natural vitamin, but the great part of them are also synthetic. But they're still the chemical, and the body handles them essentially the same way.
First of all, another thing is like on vitamin C, I understand that vitamin C tablets, such as maybe another myth, that if they sit around too long, that it's not good to use them, for instance. Maybe an argument for the food thing would be that you know what condition it's in. Whereas
you bring up a very important point that I was going to bring. There is deterioration in food. Unless it's and depends on the kind of food. And some health food stores where you don't have a turnover. That's the advantage of certain supermarkets where you have a fast turnover. And if you have a slow turnover, a lot of things get moldy, and some of the molds, as we've come to find out, the aflatoxins, for example, are carcinogens on some of the cereals, for example. Your vitamin E, a lot of people are in a wheat germ kick. It does everything for you, night or day. But but unless you keep it in a refrigerator, that becomes rancid and loses its potency in short order, you see.
Dr. Maybe I should save this question, tell you when you come to the sugar that, but over the years I've been known as an MD, and you say, what does that mean, molasses doctor? I've always been sort of a firm adherent to natural blackstrap molasses, which I buy in bulk. It comes from Hawaii. That is, it's just a natural thing that is supposed to be high in iron and vitamins, and yet some people say, well, that's still the sugar. It's not... There's no benefit.
Yeah, I'll address it.
There's a benefit in good old blackstrap molasses.
Yeah, I'll address this. I can't give you the whole skin on molasses. I've been liking molasses, too. I like molasses cookies, and I think Dorothy and Al may have some more to say on that. I want to address the thing, because that was a question, wasn't it? Raw sugar and honey. Raw sugar and honey. And we'll start there. Or white sugar. White sugar is, that's poison. That's poison. You should eat brown sugar or honey. Hmm? Well, they're all sugar. And some people say, well, but there's a little special thing in honey and brown sugar that's not in white. And that's true. There are a couple of things. There's a little bit of iron and a little bit of calcium in brown sugar that is not in white sugar. But in order to get enough to really count much for you, you'd probably have to eat 2 or 3 cups of brown sugar a day. And I don't recommend that. You're better off just taking a glass of milk, or half a glass of milk, you get far more calcium. So this is no big deal. I use brown sugar because I like brown sugar. Now, blackstrap molasses does have more iron in it. Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Maybe some sulfur, too. I don't know.
It should have.
So I can't cite you the data that molasses is but my grandmother said that's good stuff. Until proven otherwise. Now
honey is sweeter.
Yes, it is.
Because of the type of sugar.
Yeah. It's the type of sugar And I like honey. I have honey in my, well, I didn't have it in this, but I usually have a little bit in this. You don't want to eat too much sugar. We eat far too much sugar. When I get to be dictator, no candy machine. We're going to cut down on it. So that's why I like cyclamates. Well, I'm on cyclamates. You see, we have now, everybody's so uptight about this in this country, not so much in foreign countries. About these chemicals, and it's sort of gotten out of hand in a way, and a lot of our studies on cancer on chemicals is done on animals. There's some very prescribed things you have to go through to clear a product. Right now, for any new drug, it probably takes about 7 years and a few million bucks, and you're going to have a great reduction on new chemicals, new therapy agents hitting the market. There's no question about that, because of the expense of getting them cleared. And on the cyclamates, what they do, on one of the test systems they use are rats, and they put, for example, maybe the product in beeswax or something, put it in a bladder, on the wall of the bladder of rats is one of the test methods, and they also feed it, and there's certain prescribed things you go through. And if you extrapolate that data, I think there is some basis for my saying to you that the cyclamates, you know, were used in soft drinks. Huh? Mm-hmm. All right, if you drank, say if it was in 7-Up, Diet Cola, huh? if you drank, oh, say 300 to 600 bottles of Diet Cola a day from now till you're 86. There might be a slight chance that you might increase slightly your chances of having bladder cancer. I'm not real sure, but you might. But I don't think you'd make it doing that. See, that's the kind of thing we've gotten into. On a lot of these chemicals, people do not understand the dose-effect curve. That with very low doses of something, well, usually you work together and you say, if this very high dose causes this much effect, and then you drop down a little bit and this high dose also causes a little slightly effect. And so you draw a curve down and says it's a straight line, and if you take just this little amount, it'll cause that much. Well, that isn't necessarily true. In fact, most chemical dose effect curves are not straight line, but they're what we call sigmoid. And I'll give you an illustration of this. We'll take spuds. Potatoes have 150 different chemicals in them. One of the things they have in them is arsenic. Or you can take lima beans. And they have... cyanide in them, or some of your oxalates and in, well, a rhubarb, huh?
Rhubarb.
Yeah.
Rhubarb.
But if I take spud, huh? Mm. And if I extract out the arsenic in it, and I'll concentrate it, and if I take the cyanide of lima beans and give it to you, you're in trouble. Well, I can get enough out of there to kill you. But at the level you're eating spud, at the level you're eating lima beans, no sweat. No sweat. I don't want to turn you off on spuds and lima beans. On oxalates, there's kind of interesting development in this area. I happen to like rhubarb. I can't take very much of it. But it does tie up calcium. In fact, I just got a flyer out of NIH the other day that kidney stones bug a lot of people. And boy, if you got them, you know you got them, huh? It's misery. Misery. And a recent finding at the University of California is that, especially if you have malabsorption of fat, in other words, you're not handling fat well in your GI tract, and if you, especially with the presence of oxalates, you're tying up calcium, you're getting insufficient calcium, and you're getting, and it seems to enhance the increases your chance of kidney stones. And what they're doing now is what they didn't used to do: give high amounts of calcium for kidney stone prevention. In the old days, they used to cut it down. Now they're recommending, and they did a trial on it, and it seemed to work, especially in these kind of people. But it brings out that all these things we eat do have chemicals in them, including natural organic potatoes and lima beans. And just because it's a natural food, it's not necessarily good. And if you're going out to pick your mushrooms and get some toadstools, you'll find out they're very natural. But they'll put you off feet first. Another thing that you can go into some health food store today, you can get sassafras root, fresh sassafras root. Some of you are probably using it, huh? I don't recommend that. We don't use any sassafras now in any food additives. There was one time when they did. They used to put out sassafras tea. Used to be good for almost everything. And that wasn't so bad because there's a chemical in it called safrole. And it's a carcinogen, at least in animals. It causes cancer. But today you can go into a health food store and get these roots and make up your own tea. And you're taking safrole. I don't recommend that. So lay off the sassafras. Now, let's see. We are on raw milk. I didn't get finished on that, did I? That was also false. That isn't to say that if you got a goat or a cow and you're sure she is disease-free, doesn't have brucella and a lot of other things, and you use very good, clean methods in handling it, I'm not saying that's great. Go ahead and drink it. But in this day and age, boy, I'm sticking with the pasteurized, because I know a lot of people that have brucellosis from drinking raw milk. There's some big outbreaks of salmonellosis and other things. It's bad news, huh? From raw milk. So that's also false. What are some other things that I wanted to tell you? Yes. Yes, I'm sorry. We'll stop here for questions. Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, how many
of
you can ask about the whole thing? Mm-hmm. More time and the alligator.
Yeah.
How do you
see it? Yeah, well, that gets into a whole different subject. Later on. We don't fully know what's all involved in here. What we're talking about is an agent that's under scrutiny, it's under attack, it's much to discuss. And today, for a pretty good price, you can go to Mexico and get this extract from apricot seed pits. And some people say it does help in a certain cancer to keep them from growing, or may in fact arrested. I know some people that have done this. The last one I know recently died from cancer. There was a study, in fact, Mr. Biology of Cell, he's president of Sloan Kettering right now. Thomas. Lou Thomas. He said, well, we can answer this in a year or two, I think it was. And so he put some people on it to try this out, to answer this. Now, there was some information leaked from this that said that in this certain strain of mice, there appeared to be, with high levels, some arrest or some maybe slowing down or reduced incidence of cancer in this special strain of mice. But that was leaked out. I have not seen any papers on that. And the last I heard on it is that they, although it's been maybe a couple of years, they really haven't a definitive answer. And most physicians do not regard it as an effective treatment. That's the bottom line. The evidence from experiments are not definitive. Yes, back there in the blue.
What I think I'm hearing is that, for instance, these are not a complete protein unless they're served with rice. This material is not complete unless it's served with milk.
Yeah, you bring up a very good point. It's one I was going to make. In fact, at the National Academy, there was a report put out. I didn't have anything to do with it, and so it's probably more believable. But a lot of people are on a vegetarian diet. Seventh-day Adventists, for example, quite a few of them are on vegetarian diet. A lot of Indians are. And so they said, well, What about vegetarian diet? Can you really make it on it? And you can. What they did was to study really a regular diet, and then they studied a vegetarian diet, but with eggs and milk, because some people do that, and then the other one was no animal protein at all. Now, they also made it on the no animal protein at all, but you will get into trouble on that on long term on the basis that it is low in vitamin B12, which is a very important item. But that was sort of the limiting thing. But coming back to your question, which is a very good one, because it is important that you just don't live on dandelion leaves, on one kind. You need a whole diversity, and you must include legumes in there, for example, you know, the peas and the beans. So get as much variety in there. If you feel you should be vegetarian, get as much variety as you can. But if your beliefs allow you to hit some eggs and milk, you're better off. You're better off. Now, when you go to the other diet, the diet in which you have meat, which happened to be the one I go for. There, in the profession I'm in, you push food animals, but we probably eat too much beef. We should eat more fish and fowl and some of these things, and less beef. But you know, don't knock off the beef. Or lamb, which I'm very fond of, and pork. I'm ambivalent on that because I love pigs. Pigs are your brothers, I say, and my Jewish friend says that's why we don't eat them. But it's important to have a diversity in your diet. Will you go on in this, Sophie?
Yes. I was talking to Dr. Norstead last night, and he was saying that down in some of the underdeveloped countries like Costa Rica,
where they eat a lot of beans and rice, they have found that they can get a complete diet using beans and rice because they the combination supplies all amino acids.
You have to get the essential amino acids. It used to be 10, but maybe it's more now. Mm-hmm. But that's a chief. The chief is also a home economist. She'll get me for saying that. She always, we used to have a simple diet, which is a good thing, but diversity. And she always insisted on at least two vegetables, maybe three, in counting spuds, at a meal, at the dinner. And I think that's probably a pretty good rule.
Are you talking about some particular beans?
I think that's an important question, too. Mm. Beans, peas, and more now the cereal grains, what is happening? The plant geneticists are doing remarkable things. They're sort of putting things together. They're crossing even wheat and rye, you see. I mean, they're doing really crazy things. They're mixing them all up. When the lights go out, and getting all kinds of things coming out the door, but what they're doing is, you know, that was one of the problems with in the white corn in South America, low lysine, wasn't it? Now they have high lysine corn, except the South Americans don't like it, but that's another problem. But it has to have acceptance. For example, one of the things where, you know, I talked to when I was on the Food Protection Committee in National County. We had an industry group that we'd meet with now and then. An industry, you know, they'd like to also give you, they have to give you what you want, or otherwise they're out of business. Huh? And what they'd really like to do is give you a soft drink that's nutritious. And they tried some of these. And what they do is they sometimes try them in foreign countries. Like instead of cola, they'd give you maybe it's a protein hydrolysate, which would be ideal in foreign countries. You get these kids drinking pop and you flip one on them, you're giving them a good protein, you know. But the people didn't like it. They didn't like it, they rejected it. And a football player down South East, you get Gatorade. You know. But it doesn't have a lot of protein in it. So there are these developments, and now we have some cereal grains that are much better as protein supplements. They're improved content of certain of the necessary amino acids. Was there some other questions?
What do you last when some people cannot eat meat, that they get much sicker? What kind of chemicals? What do you last
with? Well, or it's probably what's there. Yeah, it's a lot of firepower in there, and boy, I know they're flatulent producers, they're gas producers. A lot of them are that. I mean, there's certain ones I can't take at all, and you got to lay low on the beans. And I'll never forget that the magician came to our high school one time, and he was trying to get this lady to say, you know. Say you don't eat onions and garlic when you go out on the date, and she said, "What don't you eat when you're going out on a date?" And she said, "Beans." Well, it was the wrong answer, but it's true. I guess. But I can't eat, for example, something I love: zucchini squash, and most of the cabbage family are great gas producers. Huh? So you got to cut down on some of these. Yes.
I have a little bit of community from my family.
Yes.
And they, of course, use some of our color beans.
Yes. Now, soybean is a pretty good protein supplement, properly treated. And in fact, a member of our Food Protection Committee, who's in charge of food science at the University of California, Davis, before that, Michigan State, a very, very competent person. And he admitted he tried some of these, what do we call them, extenders, you know, these extenders. And he had to admit that some of these extenders not only improved, for example, the quality of the hamburger, but as far as, you know, holding less grease, but also probably even more nutritious as a mixture rather than just as the meat alone. In the quiet evening, soybeans, a lot of soybeans. If it's the right kind of stuff, you know, soybeans. It's a very good protein. And of course, you hear a lot today about, and it hits my profession, and it hits agriculture very, very remarkably. In fact, one of the really prominent nutritionists, a guy at Harvard, you know, when he comes out of Harvard, you got to believe it. Only don't always believe it. But he says, boy, we got to knock off all the cattle, the food animals, because they're consuming all these high, all these grains, these high energy cereals that people should be eating. And to produce these cereal grains and then feed them into cattle, you know, you're losing so much because they're inefficient. Well, what he forgot was that in this country, over half of the land mass, and over the world, I suppose, two-thirds of the land mass is not fit for production of these high-energy cereal grains. It's only good for producing, it's grazing land. And there aren't many people I know that are good grazers, and that can utilize it, huh? The best utilization, if you can convert what we can't eat through the food animals to produce red meat, you got some going for you, see? And there are also indications that in some of these animals, low energy producers, that probably using these roughages, which we can't eat, and just supplementing them, we are pouring too much into a lot of them now. And I don't have any problem agreeing with that aspect. But there are indications that if you pick the right kind of an animal, you can probably supplement him and maybe get even a one-to-one back on him. Very close to it, you see. And that will help the thing along and do well by you and thus get very good protein. And there are other things that they don't count in there. For example, a whole insulin dip. Without the food animals, you've got no source of insulin. And many other products that I won't go into, your leathers and all of that, and wool, and I say that not only because I happen to be in the business, but because it's true. And we are working on even better animals for these kinds of conversions. Now, before I come down here, there's somebody up there that's been trying to get to me. Bro-mated flock.
The only thing I can think of, and I'm not sure this is right, but in boosting flour, one of the processes is to reduce it with bromine. At one time they did it with chlorine, but the bromine does a much better job of boosting, and it does a better job of conditioning the flour to make the flour, or to make that flour produce a better bread. It has several conditioning qualities.
The only thing I've used the bromine for in feeds with certain chemicals you can get that is very toxic, which you put into the grain to get rid of the beetles. But I think that's the answer. It can only be used for baking bread, not for anything else.
No, it's used to bleach. That's the primary function. And the other real function of bleaching is to age the flour. The best flour has to be aged. The wheat has to be aged. And of course, time is money in this processing. So bleaching makes the flour white, which supposedly people want, I guess, at one time they did, plus it does the aging. Now this can be done with either the wheat that's used for making bread flour or cake flour. It's not the bleaching process, or it's not the use of the bromine that makes a difference. It's the type of wheat that you select. You use one type of wheat for making pastry flour and another type of wheat for making bread flour. So maybe I still missed the point, I don't know.
Okay. Now, there's all kinds of hands here. Let me see, there's we'll take an order. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I gotta leave.
This could possibly be a matter of merchandising, just like when they started on silk tips and flowers, if that was something special, when it was one of the processes in the development of the flower anyway. And that some pet food or whatever, I don't know if I've heard hungry.
Yeah.
But they've gotten hold of that as an advertising.
Okay.
Did I understand you correctly that if honey was better for you than the white chicken?
I can't really say that and prove it. No. I think it's better for me. I like honey. So I got myself convinced of it.
On this honey, isn't it? Because the honey has been homogenized and the enzymes are killed. Therefore, it's not much better for you than white sugar. But if we would use the raw sugar, then, the raw honey, it would be better.
That white sugar is a bugaboo of mankind that it takes away all the good in your honey.
No, I think probably raw sugar might be better, but we need a certain amount of carbohydrate, and this is a pretty fast way, a high energy thing to do it. Our problem is too much, you know? The whole business in nutrition and everything else in life is in moderation, isn't it? I mean, if it's good, we take, you know, if one teaspoon is good, take two, sort of thing. If one steak is good, take two. You know, we got to cut down on it, and it takes discipline. Because I have an advantage over some of you, because I was in prison long enough, I think, when my stomach shrunk, so I can't eat very much one sitting. And I'm a poor keeper. I got to eat all the time, and it's your turn.
Is there any rule of thumb we can go by as far as our personal nutrition goes?
Well, there is. I'll tell you what Fred Sayre said. I think I have something by him here. And people don't always agree on these things, you know. What's that fellow, cardiovascular surgeon down at Houston? I know I'm chewing. Recently he said, diet doesn't make that much difference. Well, it does make a bit of difference. What is the best advice? This is according to Sarah and Elizabeth Whalen. And they're also from Harvard, so they also spent some time at Yale, one of them did. There are three basic rules for good nutrition. Eat a variety of foods. Watch those calories. And cut down on all the cholesterol-rich fatty foods and salt. Well, I'll tell you my feeling on that. There was one time I was more convinced than now. I'm not so sure that all these polyunsaturated fats are the bane that they're cracked up to be. And so I do use some regular butter, but I don't use very much of either one of them. I think it determines a lot on your history. For example, in the animal kingdom, I can find you a strain of rats that I can drive into hypertension by high-salt diet. I can take you another strain where you can't drive them into hypertension with high salt. They know how they can handle it. The same with cholesterol. I think some of you, and some of us maybe, can handle fairly high amounts of cholesterol. Others of you cannot. And for those, you better go low cholesterol. It isn't good to eat a lot of fat anyway. I'm looking for a beef that is tender and juicy, and it can be, without a lot of fat. And it isn't a good idea to eat a lot of that. But that's in brief, you know, to answer your question. I think that's pretty good. And he also mentions, as I talked to you earlier, don't make it all on beef. Use fish, poultry, and veal. I don't think it's a good idea to eat, you know, three eggs a day. I have a couple of weeks. But I'm no paradigm either. Yes. Yeah, you ask a very difficult question. There's a lot of studies.
Well, I wanted to
Yeah. There have been a lot of studies on this and conferences, and I have a lot of arguments on this. I think it is true, at least some people I knew at the University of California maintain this, that there are some diets today that are probably marginal on vitamin E. In the animal kingdom, in Oregon, in fact, he's the first person in the world to show a vitamin E deficiency in sheep that manifests itself as white muscle disease, and with a natural diet, and we can prevent this with a mixture of, well, just high vitamin E or vitamin E and selenium, which has turned out to also to be probably a requirement. So I think there are certain conditions where vitamin E may be helpful. Yeah. I always remember that there are no panaceas other than Holden. Now, I said maybe two people here.
Yes, I have two. I have very good. We know that fat poisons lead to the vitamin C and B, but what about beginners? We don't know how all that food is before it. So. And then also, one of the things we talked about is about the decaffeinated coffee after I done the paper at all.
Yes, that question has to do with the preservation method. What do you lose on the preservation? And you do, I think, lose on some of them. I think if the storage facilities are proper on the frozen food, I don't think you lose that much. Have you done any studies on that, you know?
There are doing some studies now on TV dinners at Washington State University. And proper storage is very good. We find that as far as vegetable servings are concerned, the servings are very small. So of course, it depends on the size of the serving.
So we'll write to see Dorothy next year, and she'll probably have an answer on that. On decaffeinated coffee, well, when I get to be dictator, no more coffee. You've got to have it. You can't live forever anyway. Here. So keep drinking it. Don't worry about it, but don't hit it too hard. I'm sure, like my old friend in Richmond used to say, everything will get you in the end. And I got creeping rigor mortis already then. I've read some of that too, but I can't cite you the evidence for pro or con on it. But what the hazard is. Well, I'd stay with the tank, I think. Of course, some people I wouldn't want to be around them in the morning if they didn't have the regular. Somebody back there. No. Now that's another fallacy. If I had been dictator, I don't think I would have erased DES. There's another thing. Here's a case where they prescribe the doses, and with some of the prescribed doses, there has been some hyperplasia manifested with people that were taking DES therapeutically. People were, see, very high doses. Now, in order to get those kind of doses, you'd probably have to eat 500 or maybe 1,000 or more pounds of beef liver from the right beef every day. It's some ridiculous amount. Maybe I'm understating. Maybe it's 20,000 pounds. It's some fantastic figure. And it's one of these things where they were supposed to keep the animals after they give them DS for a certain length of time because to allow body bio-transformation, bio-turnover of it, and some of them are fudging a little bit on it, but there wasn't that much in it. What it does end up doing is the cost of your beef will be at least 10% higher, because that's what the saving of using DS. Yes.
Yes. You come up with a good thing, you take vitamins and salt or whatever is bad for you. And I've noticed in the past couple of years in the American food industry, there's been a big movement questioning the cold cereal industry. The phone for vitamins. You get 100% of the minimum daily requirement. And I was wondering, if you eat those cereals in the morning and then eat a regular diet for the rest of the day, if you keep doing this for a while, could those vitamins show up in your body? Could that affect
you? It depends. Did you all hear the question? This is an important question, because the answer is sort of yes and no, because on some vitamins you can store for a while, and others not at all. Most of the B-complex vitamins, you're running them through pretty fast. Same with vitamin C, isn't it? And some of them, it's these mega vitamin takers, it's like a people think vitamins are panacea. If you are on a good diet today, you don't need them. You don't need them. Unless you're in a situation where you're not handling something properly, maybe some will help you. And vitamin A and D, they can be toxic. I can show you a lot of data of people have taken too much of that, or animals. A lot of people raising dogs, for example, hunting dogs. No, boy, they're really going to treat this hunting dog well, and boy, they pour the A and D to them, and their bones go to pot. And it's a sad case. So knock off with that stuff. And vitamin C, that's still a controversial issue, because one of the things Pauling, he came out with it and said, boy, it prevents colds and all. There have been some studies on this, some of them fairly definitive. And the evidence in most cases seems to be that it doesn't probably help prevent colds very much, unless you are not getting enough vitamin C to begin with. But the large doses, in fact, I think on one study we're using about 3 grams a day, which is awful, but there was some indication maybe the cold didn't last as long. But there are some indications from some Canadian work, as I recall, that showed that the vitamin C did have some antiviral properties. But the way I look at that is, if you feel better, take a few hundred milligrams, a couple of tablets a day. If it makes you feel better, they don't cost that much. All right, it's been good to be with you. And,